This is a Pinball News production.
It's a pretty big crowd. Giving away free stuff does that, huh? All right, so Phoebe's walking around. Anybody, if you're coming in late, please make sure you get a raffle ticket. We're going to give some shirts away at the end. I'm going to try to talk fast. I have a lot of stuff I wanted to cover and leave some time at the end to give some things away. So we're going to talk about multicolor displays and some of the new stuff that we're doing. Some quick announcements. At the end of last month, we released another title for the Color GMD platform. This is the eighth title, Creature from the Black Lagoon. This is also the first display that we've done that we didn't color ourselves. We actually got some help from Kenny Hardy, who's a Southern California pinhead. He's part of the Orange County Pinball League and had pestered us enough to get involved that we finally started working on some tools to enable other people to begin helping. And came out really nice. There's a creature set up in the play hall that you guys will be able to take a look at if you haven't seen it yet. New logo. So we specifically did this because we wanted to start doing some things for promotions, especially tied in with Expo. So this logo was designed by Zachary Kent of Kent Designs in Santa Cruz. I don't know if you guys have seen the Pacific Coast Pinball logo before. He does a really good job with pinups. And originally I wanted a pinup, and after a lot of discussion and metamorphosizing, we ended up with this. So we're going to give away shirts that have the same logo. And then thanks to Mark, we printed up a bunch of stickers. So if you don't walk away with a shirt, please come up and get a sticker at the end. They're up on the front table. And we're also trying to use this to help promote our Facebook site. We've been doing a lot of things where we're showing pictures and videos of some of the new things as they come out. Facebook kind of gives us a license to spam you. So if you like us on Facebook, we will keep you entertained. And we're doing some giveaways. We gave away some T-shirts last week. And we still have more shirts that we'll probably be giving away in the future. So special thanks to the people who bring the games here and help us share them with you. I'm coming from Southern California, so it's not really possible for me to bring games up here. But Phoebe and Larry have been a huge support for the last 3 years in bringing a lot of games from Ohio here. Rob was nice enough to bring his Monster Bash this year. And Brian Coney's another Ohio pinhead, and then Rob and Joe. Rob brought the creature, and Joe brought a Whitewater. So I think we have 7 games total, and I'll talk a little bit more about that at the end. All right, so some things about Color GMD. So the whole project started in 2009, which was before Jersey Jack had announced a new pinball company, and it was before anybody was really talking about introducing color into pinball machines. And where the idea came from was that as part of the Orange County Pinball League, there's a few guys that have contributed things to the pinball community for new products and new mods. And one of those guys is Bill Long. And so I don't know if you guys know Bill, but he has that UFO pinball LED kit that goes in Attack from Mars. And it's probably one of the best mods out there for pinball machines. It's one of those mods that doesn't really look like a mod. It looks like it should have been there from the beginning. But the thing that was really cool about that was Bill found a way to take what he did professionally and figure out how to contribute something new to the pinball community. And I have an engineering background, and I was trying to come up with something nice and compact and small like Bill's idea, and didn't have any good ideas. But at one Orange County meeting, I remember I was staring at a whole line of games with the traditional orange displays, and it sort of hit me, why are all the displays orange? Why, you know, in 2009, why are we still looking at orange displays? Why hasn't any of the new display technology made its way into games? And I just sort of wondered, I think I was watching Medieval Madness and the trolls were up, and I started to wonder, what would that look like in color? Would it have a big impact or not? And so I went home and started playing with some things on the computer and was able to animate some things, and it looked pretty cool. And so then I started looking for ways to actually implement it and tie it into a game. And I'll show you some of the evolution of that. But the goals really for the project were that I didn't want to have to rely on a new pinball company coming up with a new platform. So I was looking for a way to take something that could retrofit into existing games. And I also wanted to do it in a way that it didn't upset anyone. So it was really important to try to preserve the integrity of the original game and artwork. I didn't want to have to modify any manufacturer ROMs. There's a lot of sensitivity around that. So it's something that really operates at the interface between the game and where the normal DMD would be. So down at the bottom there, there's a picture of what everybody has become familiar with for pinball displays. It's a very low-res display. It's only 128 columns and 32 rows. And they're also high-voltage gas plasma displays. And there's no difference in brightnesses. I know everybody is used to saying there's four shades. Really, the way these displays work is they scan, and you have to modulate how long the dot stays lit to try to get a difference in brightness level. And so all the old games, they only had four levels, and the newer Stern games have 12. But really, the premise of all this work is sort of this obnoxious title, is that the orange displays kind of blow, for lack of a better word. And so these same displays have been used in games since 1991, really since the DMD, or since video was introduced into pinball machines. And it didn't make any sense to me until I started working on it, and then I realized it's really, really challenging to try to figure out how to incorporate something new into the existing platform, because you're dealing with limited memory, you're dealing with limited processor power. You can't just start changing ROMs even if you wanted to, because the infrastructure is not there to do it. And I had to start thinking about other ways that we might be able to enable this. So not long after, this is sort of the first stage of the idea. You can see that there's a, I think I bought this at Walmart. It's a 15-inch display from Walmart. It's still in the monitor casing. And off to the side, there's this Xilinx reference board that you can get for a couple $100. And you can do all kinds of different development for anything that you want. The nice thing about this board is it had a VGA output, and you know there was a way to interface the DMD to this and bring VGA out and actually display it on the monitor. And this was the first time where I actually had the video interactive with the game, where you could flip the flippers and hit the ramp or hit the orbit, and you'd see the color video running. And it was mostly just this pre-canned animation clips. There wasn't any score at that point. So it was sort of easy to color because it was always the same. Every time you played the game, it looked exactly the same. And then that evolved into this engineering prototype. This is basically the decased, this is hard to control. This is the decased monitor. So you could see inside, here's the power supply for that monitor. And then here's that reference board. And I think it's just adhesived onto the back of the monitor that came in that case. And then Chris Enright, who I'll talk about in a minute, actually manufactured these custom brackets so that we could mount it to the speaker panel. This was pretty cool, but it used compact fluorescence. And the nasty thing about compact fluorescence is you need about 1,500 volts to drive it. So that's happening there. And then this prototype was also a little bit hairy, and all this exposed metal that was running the mains voltage. So I took a few shocks off of this one. Luckily, I'm still here. But you can see that this is a high-voltage DMD cable. I had it wired into the power supply board. And then that was generating the 5 volts over to the Xilinx board. And then here's the DMD ribbon cable that I interfaced to this. And so that was the first working display. We put that in a game and showed it at the Orange County Pinball League. And people kind of liked it. The display quality on it wasn't that great when you looked at it from odd angles. If you were looking at it head on and you bent down so that you were face on with the display, it looked awesome. So that was the original prototype. And this was if anybody saw the original AFM video, this was what we used when we shot that video. And this was the stage things were at when I started contacting people to see, is there any interest in this as a product? You know, I didn't know if the purists would really go for this. I had a lot of encouragement within Orange County saying, yeah, you should go do something. But in terms of trying to actually make it into a business, I wasn't sure. So this was the original. And one of the guys I talked to was Rick Bartlett. He had just acquired the rights to some of the Williams IP through Planetary Pinball. And he was very encouraging. He said, yeah, I think you should do it. So I said, okay, I'll put some more work in and try to come up with something that we might be able to share with you guys where you won't kill yourselves. So this was a pre-production prototype. This is the display that I showed at PPE and here at Expo 2 years ago. This was before we actually sold anything, and we had it in Larry's game over in the Players Hall. If you're familiar with our displays now, you can see it's a little bit different than what we sell today. The circuit board is bigger. There's cutouts in the aluminum frame. We did that because the previous display was so heavy, we were afraid that we were going to crack the plastic standoffs. So we needed to re-engineer it to make it lighter. The downside of this design was it let a lot of light out the back of the display into the back box. So that didn't really work either. We needed to make some changes for that. And then this board was supposed to have USB. It didn't make it. I goofed up a little bit. And you can also see there were some transformers there because it was originally designed for the compact fluorescent. We got lucky because all these LED backlight displays started to roll out right around this time. And the other thing we did is we moved up to a high-res display. Even though we didn't need the resolution, we needed the viewing angle. So that's why these displays cost a bit more than we would like. This is what it looks like today. So here's our modified bracket. You can see it's solid. You can see the smaller board there. There's four buttons on it that you can use to select different settings. We only light up the center of the display, just the area where the window is for the video. You can see it sticks up just a little bit over a standard WPC95 speaker panel. So it's not a perfect fit, but we made it work. And the nice thing about that, too, is that everything's running off low voltage with the LEDs, so it's only 5 volts and 12 volts. It plugs into your power driver board instead of your high voltage DMD board. So we've had some customers who were happy because they blew up their high voltage and they didn't need it anymore to drive the new display. The other thing we got working was the USB port, and we're using that extensively now. Originally, it was just there to fix mistakes, but now we're using it extensively to allow you guys to reprogram your own displays. I'll talk a little bit more about that. So that was that's where we are now. The company started officially in January of 2012. It's based in San Clemente, and Color DMD Displays LLC is the name of the company that's responsible for the manufacture and marketing of these displays. And it's currently two people, me on the right and Chris Enright on the left. And I'm handling most of the technical stuff for the platform. I'm also the guy that responds to your emails when you say that you have issues. Chris has been doing most of the coloring. I'll talk a little bit more about that on the following slides. So this is what we do within Color DMD Displays LLC, what the official company is. So from a manufacturing standpoint, we purchase a lot of parts. So the LCDs and the electronic components, we get those from traders and distributors, and you know, sometimes we have to search hard to find quality LCDs to put in your displays. We contract out some of the custom metalwork and PC cables, PCBs and cable assemblies. And after we get all of that stuff back, we ourselves we'll have, with some help that we bring on, we'll assemble everything, test everything, package it, and ship it to you. So every display that's sent out, we've hand-tested ourselves before you guys get it. For distribution, so I mentioned Rick before. Rick runs Bay Area Amusements and Planetary Pinball. We also have two distributors internationally, Pinball Palace in the UK and Ministry of Pinball in the Netherlands. I don't know if Bert's here. I know Bert's walking around somewhere. So also, we ship worldwide from our own e-commerce site. So you can go to our website and click on the store link, and basically we'll ship it just about anywhere. These are the products that we've released so far. So the first product was Attack from Mars. That was back in April 2012. So we've only been doing this for 18 months. So it's kind of amazing to me how far we've come in a relatively short period of time. But Attack from Mars, we did a short run, and then that disappeared, I think, in a day. So we did another short run. Medieval we released in August of that year. So while I was trying to finish up Attack, Chris had started on Medieval. And then I was working on some technical things for Medieval, and Chris started on Atoms, and that was October of 2012. So that was last year. And then this year we've introduced Star Trek in February. Whitewater and Sigma both came out in May. So Whitewater was a conventional multicolor. Sigma was something different. And I have more on that. But in conjunction with Sigma, we also unlocked the platform. And that was partially in response to things that you guys were asking us for, and partially because we had done enough games that it was becoming really hard to stock things and have the right number of this type versus that type. So we made a bold decision to allow you guys to go crazy and reprogram things, and so far it's worked out okay. So I think it was the right decision. Scared Stiff came right after. So we released those two things in May. 1 month later, we had Scared Stiff in June. 2 months later, Monster Bash in August. And then the Monster Trifecta, I think, was completed in September with Creature. So we'll probably be done with Monster stuff for a little while. So I know everybody wants to know what's next and when is it coming. And we usually won't say because we don't always know. What we're trying to do now in order to get new titles out, I mentioned earlier that Kenny Hardy did Creature, and that was the first title that we did that was colored with an outside artist. It was an experiment, and I think it largely went the way we expected, which was that the tools that we have still require a pretty high level of support to get good results out of it. And that coloring a game, it's more than just coloring. The coloring is sometimes the easy part. To make the tools work well, it really requires some problem-solving skills. And Chris and I both have engineering backgrounds, and I think we're used to working in that space. And so I would say that we're stronger on technical and maybe weaker on art. We have people that want to help us more on the art side, which is good, but we're probably going to need to keep helping with some of the problem-solving work. And so that's part of the reason why we're reluctant to just let things fly and just respond to the calls for open source tools. So what we're trying to do instead is bring on community support in a way that is manageable. And so what we've started to do is engage with community members as an independent contractor. So basically you come on and we'll give you access to tools and support. There's a little bit of compensation provided, and in exchange, when you're done and we say, okay, this is good and it's something that we can publish, ColorDMD Displays owns that and we support it and we put it out there. And so we're working with several people now, and there's a few games that are in the works that I won't go further into. But so I don't know which one I'll hit first, but there are a few more Bally Williams games in the works that hopefully either end of this year or early next year you guys will start to see. And we'll continue to evaluate using open tools. But I think before we can do that, we need to have some maturity in what the tools are, and we also need to have a support group. So part of this goal is to hopefully the people that are coloring things now, they'll want to help in the future. And so that will take some of the load off of Chris and I in terms of teaching other people how to use it or how to solve some of the issues. But I think the role for ColorDMD would still be to, you know, maintain control of what gets released. We want to make sure that we have good quality. We want to make sure that the manufacturers are happy, that their IP is being dealt with responsibly. And so that will probably be the direction that things go forward in. All right, so let's talk a little bit about why I say that it's more than just coloring. If you haven't seen a ColorDMD seminar before, this is sort of the way things work. So the signal comes in from the DMD, and the first thing that we do is try to recognize what's being sent. So there's some algorithms there for frame identification. And then following that, we'll do some processing. Usually it's a color lookup. And we may have to change the formatting to go from the DMD timing to the LCD timing and that kind of thing. So there's a video interface there, and then we come out on the LCD. The way it gets implemented is on this board. So all the processing is really done here in, this is called an FPGA, which is basically programmable hardware. So we can change the code around, which is why we're able to do multicolor displays and we're able to do upscaling displays and that kind of thing. We can use the same platform and basically change what set of processing is done here. This is more powerful in some ways than a general purpose processor because it's capable of highly parallel operations. And so we're able to do things that you probably couldn't do with just a simple microprocessor. Just a quick review of the other things that are on here. Here's the power supply. We use a switching power supply for low voltage. Here's an oscillator. Here's the USB interface controller. And here's the memory that is driving the processor that stores the color ROM information. All right, so how we color games. So the first step is that we need to recognize what's being sent. So we really need to build up a library of all the video frames from the game that are being sent, which isn't always easy because there's some sequences that will only show up under very particular circumstances. And so this is a very manual process of flipping switches and triggers in the right sequence and looking for Easter eggs and trying to get the game to show us everything that's in there. It also changes when you go from a one-player game to a two-player game to a four-player game. You know, where the scores are in the images, it all changes. So we need to collect that information. Then the next step is we try to generate a unique ID for everything that's there. And so all of that stuff is pretty much done offline. The methods that we use during that offline processing are the same frame recognition methods that the hardware has to run. So it has to be simple enough that we can actually implement it on the hardware. And then, again, offline, we'll paint all the frames. We'll basically throw color on top of the dots. We don't change the dots that are there, so the dots, it's more or less shining through the color that we lay down. And we'll create this big database of the IDs and the color information that matches those IDs, and that's what we save in the ROM. We don't save any of the actual dot values. So the general idea is pretty easy, right? Capture everything, paint it, and then have the system play it back. What could go wrong? Okay, this is more of the same. I just wanted to show, it's hard to see here, but the way we can color stuff is we don't have to be really accurate with how we lay down color, because this whole section here is mostly just green, and where the dots are, they'll shine through and pick up the green color, and where there's no dots, it's black, and so it stays black. A lot of people, when we first rolled out with this, thought we were doing kind of like a Game Boy thing where we just take the four gray levels and map it to four colors, and you know, from what I told you, it's more involved than that. So, you know, where the darks and the brights are on the green are different locations than where the darks and the brights are on the white, and we want white to stay where it belongs and green to stay where it belongs and not to have white and green spots all over the screen. So that's sort of the basic coloring. This may be hard to see. There's some red over these dots in this area. And what I'm trying to show is that the coloring engine that I just described works really well when you're dealing with pre-canned animations that always look the same. When you have scores come up on the screen, the score is changing all the time. It would be impossible for us to identify every possible score on every possible frame and put white exactly where it belongs, right? So we had to come up with some nifty ideas for how to minimize the amount of work that we had to do so that it was something that was realizable instead of just a science experiment. And so this red area here shows some masking. So we're trying to use some masking to basically identify the area that doesn't change all the time and keep off the stuff that is changing. Some other challenges that we face, you know, even using that simple technique, sometimes we have loop or ramp counters that count forever, and they're in an inconvenient spot on the screen that makes it hard to mask off. We have problems with screen scrolling and fades, where you have one frame sort of is hiding what the frame is behind it and then slowly reveals it. And it's hard to recognize until enough of it is revealed to see what it is. We have moving backgrounds that aren't synchronized to the foreground animation, like the stars behind the Star Trek logo. And they actually use that star field, that moving star field, as background on a lot of different animations. Objects that can appear in a large number of different combinations. So two examples there, Cousin It as in a track mode. When he's walking across the screen, he'll throw things out of his hat, and it lands on the ground. And it's the two things that he throws are different every time. I think there's 10 different things, which would give you 100 combinations of frames that you would have to capture. And it would just be a nightmare if we had to do that all the time. Also, the trolls in Medieval, you have two trolls. They're not really synchronized, so each one is moving independently. You hit one troll, and you see the rock bash him on the head. The other troll's just happy. He's doing his own thing. So these are the things that make it hard. So a lot of times, these can be overcome by ingenuity, by problem solving. Sometimes we have to resort to brute force. And in the past, I was doing a lot of updating to the coloring engine to try to add new features to deal with some of this stuff. Of all the challenges that we face, the killer challenge is the video modes. AFM, we cheated and got away with it. So for AFM, the video mode has all the ships coming down from the top of the screen, and you have a tank that's on the bottom that's shooting up at them. And so we basically made it so that everything above this line is green and what's below the line is red. This square in here was a different shade of green than what's here, but it gave the perception that there was a multicolor display going on, but it was pretty primitive. When we moved to Medieval, which was the second game, we had a much bigger problem with video modes, because the video mode in Medieval has this farmer that runs back and forth with a pitchfork. It's like a video game, and he's moving around and he's stabbing things, and objects are moving in front of each other, behind each other, exploding. There was no way that we could just divide the screen up the way we did before. And so I went through what turned out to be a very big job to come up with an alternate coloring engine that works with sprites, which are basically these small graphical objects that move around the screen. And this new engine can real-time identify and track things as they're moving around. And this has helped us a lot, not only with video modes, but with some of those random sequences like Cousin It throwing two different things behind his head. We're able to actually track what he threw and identify what it was. So here's an example of that if you haven't seen it before. So you can see the farmer running, and the babies are moving in front of him, and the pitchfork's stabbing the birds. And so there's quite a lot of complicated action going on. And to make all of this work, there's a lot of manual coding involved to try to basically pattern match and colorize all of these separate objects. So the summary for all of this is that coloring frames is easy, but using the engine to make it look good is pretty hard. But it's rewarding when it works. And the reaction that we've gotten from you has been amazing, and that's really what's prompted us to keep trying to make it better and extend it to more titles. So thank you for that. All right, so what's new? So Sigma is this thing that we released in May. Where the name comes from, I mentioned that Chris and I are engineers, so Sigma's it's a Greek letter that's used for math. It basically represents summation for the big sigmas, and lowercase sigmas are often used for deviations. And both of those kind of describe what we did with the Sigma platform. So it's a summation in the sense that we incorporated all of the IP that we had. We made it so that you could run it all on the same display. But we added some deviation with the upscaling. So something new that nobody had really tried before or seen before. This was released in May, and in unlocking the platform, we basically set it up so that even if you had bought an older display, you could update it by getting a new product key, which we give for free, and you can program your display, and that'll unlock it. And now you can download and install any of the color ROMs that we support. I think that's what I wanted to say about that. So the goals of that were to add value for the customers. You know, the displays are expensive, and people would ask the question, so what happens if I sell my game and I have to sell the display with it? What if I want to keep the display? You know, can I move it to another game? And so we wanted to add something from that standpoint, but we also needed to simplify the way we stock things and ship things. So going forward, since May, every display ships exactly the same way. Our website's a little bit confusing because we still list all the separate products. Probably have to clean that up, but it does help us identify what you guys are interested in and what you're still buying. So, but no matter what game you buy, it'll ship the same way. It basically comes up in what I would call Twilight Zone mode. It's black and white and has some scanline effects. But you can take any ROM from the website and put it in the USB drive and reprogram it. The one caveat I want to say with this is, although we've unlocked it for all existing titles, there's no guarantee that anything that we do in the future will be compatible or supported with the current display. So I know some people are buying it now thinking, well, I'll get it now and I'll wait for that game to come out that I really want and then I'll just convert it over. you know, we may upgrade the platform in the future, and some, and we may add new features to the coloring engine that don't work on the current platform. So, you know, please, if you're buying something, buy it for your needs today. Here's a picture of the Sigma programming. So it's pretty simple. You put the USB stick in there, you hold down this button for 5 seconds, and it'll automatically upload the code to the ROM. There's a video on our website, if that was too confusing, that shows exactly how to do it. It's a pretty simple procedure. I think most people figured it out on their own without needing our help. The Sigma ROM that ships, I mentioned it's black and white. It's actually selectable. There's a few different display modes. There's also 49 different colors that you can pick from. Plasma displays and LED displays that you get today, they're all single color. You know, you can go and buy a blue display or a green display, but it stays that color. The advantage of LCD is that we can pretty much generate any color that you want. I think we have 18-bit color, so it's like 256,000 colors. We thought that would be too many to step through, so we boiled it down to 48 different color hues and white. So we've been advertising 49 different colors. That's where it comes from. If it's not enough, let us know. We can add more. But it's basically an easy menu selection. You just use those buttons on the back. You go and find the color setting, and then you can just step through the colors until you find one that you like. Okay, so another new thing that we added when we released Sigma was this upscaling mode. At the time, there was a lot of discussion about LED displays and the appearance of grid lines, and we always had the advantage with the LCD that we can get a nice perfect grid spacing, but it occurred to us, since everybody's complaining about grids, what if we can get rid of the grid altogether? We have a high-resolution display, and there's really no reason why we can't use all the pixels in that display. Some of the benefits of that are that we end up with a brighter LCD output because we're letting light through in all the locations instead of blacking out half the display. We can take advantage of improved resolution, and we can also do some novel display effects like the scanline effect. So this is what we released in May, and you can see there's three different modes. There's the classic dots. We haven't taken it away, so if you love your dots, they're still there. This is the HD upscaling that we had in May. And then it may be a little bit hard to see, but there's a scan line that overlays this. And that was really done for Twilight Zone. Some people wanted black and white displays in their Twilight Zone, and we thought, well, what if we put the scan lines and it actually looks more like a TV? And so that was pretty cool. We showed that at Texas Pinball earlier this year. And we've gotten a lot of positive feedback on it. There was a little bit of criticism, right, Martin? So we wanted to see if we could make it a little bit better. So the headline news for today is that we're releasing a new version of Sigma. It should be on the website whenever I get a chance to put it up there, maybe later today. It'll be there by the time you get home. So this is the Sigma 2.2 release, and one of the features here is that we've improved the upscaling. So the thing that people complained about before is that maybe it looked a little bit too smooth. With the text, it looked a little bit blurry, which was interesting to me because there's really no blurriness. It's a very sharp transition between the black and the white. But if you can see this, the white got a little bit fatter than the dots were before. And the black space between the white got a little bit narrower. And it sort of gave this perception that, I don't know, you pumped it up with air or something, and it looked weird, and people didn't like it. So there was also some dark and light banding around the letters, some dark and light banding in some of these straight lines. So this is the new Sigma 2.2 upscaling algorithm. So you can see everything's a lot tighter. It's the same proportions now as what we had with the dots. A lot of that dark and light banding you can see around the shoulders or around the text is gone. I think I have a close-up of the text. You can see it a little bit better. So you can see at the B's, you know, there was like a transition from white to gray to white that was kind of ugly, and this was fat. The holes in the P got smaller. You can see it's now back to the size that it should be. So a little bit less aggressive on some of the smoothing, but also a lot of work went into this to try to get the proportions better and more accurate to what you see with the actual dots. So hopefully you experiment with it and you like it. Okay, so we've also shown some Stern stuff. I was supposed to remove that title. It kind of blew my big announcement. But so these are pictures that we showed on Facebook of a prototype that we had running at California Extreme earlier this year. And so this is Lord of the Rings, and this is actually the 2.1 upscaling. These were old pictures, but they were easy for me to grab for this presentation. We did Simpsons with just the full HD upscaling without the scan lines. That looked pretty cool when we did it. I showed Tron, so this is just Sam, which is the higher level of shading running in dots mode. And then at California Extreme, we had a Transformers and a Metallica LE both running with the Sigma display. But it was pure prototype. It wasn't ready to be released. So the big news now is that Sigma 2 has multi-platform support. We've always had the WPC 95 and the WPC mounting settings. So what's new is there's a setting for White Star, and there's a setting for Sam. So now you guys can take this display and put it in your Sterns and change the dot colors to any of the 49 colors, or experiment with the display modes and have fun with it. This is a lie. It's not available now. I haven't put it there yet, but it will be very shortly. So for WPC and WPC 95 games, if you've already got our display, it's easy. You just download the ROM, install it, have fun. Power mounting solutions for Stern. We're going to come out with some things to make this easier later this year. If you can't wait, do-it-yourself mounting and powering is possible. The power comes from the 12-volt, 5-volt harness that's near the coin door that everybody's using to light up their speaker LED lighting and their under cabinet lighting and whatever other mods you have that's running off of 12 or 5 volts. My only concern is please be careful. If you reverse the 12 volts and the 5 volts, you will definitely damage the board, and you'll be sending me an email, please help me, and you won't be happy, and I won't be happy, and we'll have to try to fix your board. Here's the mounting location for the power cable. So, you know, basically you need to have one end has that 3-pin Molex connector, and the other pin, the other end looks like the IDC Molex that plugs into the regular display. All right, so to make it work with the existing bracket, you can see the holes are narrower for Williams than they are for where the Stern holes are. But the bracket is wide enough that you can catch it with the current screws. You can put some washers there and help hold it in place a little bit better. But it's pretty straightforward. Just make sure you hook up your ground. You know, make sure this is in tight enough that it's not going to fall backwards into your cabinet. Sam is easy. White Star is a little bit harder because for the White Star displays, they have the display board mounted to the back of the DMD. So we're modifying our bracket to, in the future, we'll be able to better support. This is a prototype that you can see here. It's going to change from this. But we'll be better able to support the White Star brackets if you want to get a new one, or if you want to get a display that will reach the holes on the for the SAM mounting, too. So some assemblies required here. You can do it. Maybe we'll put instructions up on the site so that you don't damage anything. You'll need to get a 14-pin ribbon cable to run from the display connector here over to our board. You can get those from DigiKey. You'll also need to find a way to mount this display board so that it stays insulated. You don't want anything shorting against the metal bracket here. But it's possible if you want to do it. So have fun. Be careful. Again, we will supply a mounting kit. We'll make it available before the end of the year, so if you can wait. If you're going to try to do it yourself, the biggest risk is that power cable construction. Just please be careful. If you reverse those two cables, you blow up your 1.2-volt regulator on the board. It's surface mount. It's hard to replace unless you're good doing surface mount soldering, and so you'll be sending it to us or somebody else who's good at that. You know, please seek help from a knowledgeable tech before you try to do something like this. All right, so games that we'll have on display at Expo, Attack from Mars, Medieval Madness, Monster Bash, those are both in the Players Hall. Monster Bash is over in the Vendor Hall. It's in Rob's area. It's sort of in the corner, but if you look for it, you'll see our topper on the top of it. Creature and Whitewater, and then we're going to display this new Stern mode on Spider-Man and a Metallica Premium. So check it out. You can see what video looks like with upscaling. I think it looks a little bit better. You take a look and tell us what you think. And the Metallica Premium looks really cool with the hand-drawn animations with the upscaling. Okay, so I'm going to answer some questions. Is there anybody who didn't get a ticket? Raise your hand if you didn't get a raffle ticket, because we're going to give some shirts away while I answer questions. Everybody's got one? So what number did we end up with?
3 and 7.
3 and 7. All right. If the last number on your ticket is a 3 or a 7, come up and get a shirt. All right, and while that's happening, I'll try to answer questions. So if you have a question, just raise your hand. And over there in the back.
So, Rob, if I could, for the thing I'm talking about, for like Twilight Zone, is that just a trick that I get plug and play into the script that I already have?
So you don't need any new chip. So Twilight Zone runs off the standard Sigma ROM. So basically you put the USB stick in. Well, it ships with Sigma. So if you bought the display, it'll come default with the Sigma ROM installed.
So we need your display, your new display.
You need our display, but you don't need to change anything else in your back box besides swapping out the DMD and putting in the color DMD.
Okay. Thank you.
Greg? Okay, so the question is, can we do the Sigma upscaling with the colorized games? And the answer is yes, but the processor that we have on this board now is probably not powerful enough to do both. So to get there, we might have to do a different board update in the future. But it looks pretty cool. Any other questions?
Do you know of anybody running color DMD on a location machine?
There's a number of operators who sent us photos that we posted to our Facebook account that I think they've been up and running for like a year now, mostly in like barcade type settings, but so it's, you know, fairly well protected environment. But yeah, so far I'm not aware of any issues in having the games running all the time.
Did you design the PCB yourself?
I designed the PCB.
Did you write the firmware?
I did everything myself. So the firmware is, it's written in RTL, Verilog, which is a hardware programming language. Within that RTL, there's an embedded processor that's running assembler. So I had to write C, assembly, and RTL, and there's a lot of different skills required for this. It's a Xilinx FPGA, a Spartan 3. It's a Pico Blaze. It's a Xilinx Pico Blaze. Any other questions? Martin?
Well, you've done Stern and Data Reach and Sega support for single color. Of course, we always want more. So when can we expect the full color?
Okay, so Martin's question was, now that we have Sigma working in Stern games, when can we expect to see multicolor? So the first step was to get the interface working to the display board, so we've taken care of that now. There's a little bit more work because of the way the signal timing works between Williams games and Stern games, that some of our color processing does need to be updated. It's definitely something that we'd like to support, so we're trying to work that out. But I'm hoping that by the middle of next year we have support for that. Over here.
Is there any future hope of price reduction without compromising the battle margins?
So the question is there any hope of price reduction without reducing our profit margins? They kind of go hand in hand, unfortunately. What I would love is if the technology that we're using were to get cheaper. And we've been waiting for that to happen since we started. So far, we haven't really seen a price change in the LCD panels, which is one of the most significant costs that we can't control. So I'm not sure. I don't think that we could lower the price without it without affecting our profit margins. Any other questions? All right, I think we have enough to maybe try one more number. Phoebe, you got another number? 9. If your ticket ends in 9, come on up. All right, thanks everyone for coming. If you have any other questions, I'll be at the show through Saturday, so just feel free to stop me. I'm happy to talk and answer other questions. Thank you.